From 9 to 5 Mac, this is Stack Trace, a show where we talk about Apple news and rumors from a developer's perspective. I am John Sundell, and I'm joined for this Season 2 premiere by my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Guy?
Hi, John. Very excited about the new season. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm really excited, too. It feels like it's been a couple of months since we last did the show, but it's been just a little bit over a month, right? So, yeah, time really flies.
Yeah, you get into the habit of recording every other week, and now every week, and you kind of feel like there's something missing from your life when you're not recording.
Yeah, absolutely. This, we have this iMessage conversation where we talk about lots of stuff every single day, and usually when we have something that is like really interesting, we usually say, let's save it for the show. But it's been hard to say that for the last couple of weeks because, well, we had to wait so long to do the show, but we also wanted to take a little bit of a break, and we have a new format for the show that we are really excited about, which we'll tell you about in a second. So it was good to take a break, but now it's great to be back. So as you might have heard there, and you might have seen on our new logo and the fact that Stack Trace is now hosted on the 9to5 Mac website, you might have thought, there's something here, something to do with 9to5 Mac. And that's because we are now part of 9to5 Mac. Stack Trace is now part of the kind of 9to5 Mac family, which is super exciting. So, Rambo, why did we do this? Like, why did we join our good friends at 9to5 Mac?
Well, first of all, I've been there for more than a year now, and they are a great bunch. And they have, in my opinion, but I'm biased, the best website about Apple in the entire internet. And so they have podcasts, they have a happy hour and the daily podcasts, and they also have some partner podcasts with the other websites on the 9to5 family of sites. And they came to us and talked about how it would be interesting to have Stack Trace be a part of their entire podcast lineup. And we thought it would be a good fit because the subject we talk about is very in line with the website. We even talk about much of the stuff I post there. So, yeah, and this will allow us to, first of all, make the show weekly, which has been a dream since forever.
Yeah.
And it also gives us more support in terms of editorial stuff and sponsorships. And we don't have to worry about hosting anymore because 9to5 Mac is providing all of that. So I think it's a win-win situation we have here.
Yeah, absolutely. And the key there, I think, for me was the fact that we are referring to so many 9to5 Mac reports, most of them by you, all the time on the show. So there was like a very clear overlap there between, you know, the stuff that you do for 9to5 Mac and the stuff that we do here. So now that everything is kind of under one roof, we'll be able to, I think, do even more cool stuff and really improve the show as well. And of course, one really nice outcome of this is, like you mentioned, that we can now do this show every single week. This is one thing that we had as a goal when we started our Patreon. Unfortunately, we could never reach that goal with the Patreon, which was, you know, one reason why we started looking into kind of alternative ways of supporting this show, rather than relying on kind of direct funding from you, from the listeners, to instead, you know, use sponsorships and now this deal with 9to5 Mac and they helping us out to really make it possible for us to spend more time with the show, making it more high quality, and also doing it every week, which is super exciting.
Also, may I mention that the move to 9to5 Mac was under wraps for quite a while, kind of like an Apple announcement.
Yeah.
And it leaked.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah, so we updated the Apple Podcasts entry, or the people at 9to5, they published an entry there to like preview how the artwork was going to look like and stuff, and someone actually found it.
Exactly. A spelunker. Someone was spelunking the spelunking podcast.
Oh yeah, that was very funny. And yeah, but now it's official.
Now it's official, and it's really cool.
And we are going to call it Apple. No, not that kind of announcement.
Exactly. And it's the thinnest and lightest version of Stack Trace we've ever made.
Yeah, best version.
It's at least twice as fast as the old version. But I think the most important thing for us to kind of say here about this move and about this new format, this new season, is that very few things are actually going to change about the show. We will start having sponsorships, and we're going to try to always have really relevant, good sponsors that we think you're really gonna like. We have two sponsors already for this episode, which are really, really, really great. But also, of course, that we'll be able to start doing the show weekly, which will be a, you know, huge plus. But apart from those things, that nothing will really change about the show. It will still be, you know, me and Rambo doing this the same way we've been doing it before. So I think it's just an overall very positive change. And another thing we just also want to say is that while we are closing our Patreon, and we have notified all of our patrons about that, and we did our last after show in January with more details, we really, really want to thank everyone who did support us on Patreon. That really meant a lot to us. And even though it didn't really work out, you know, in the end, we didn't really hit those goals. We didn't receive that amount of funding that would allow us to do these weekly shows that we now are able to do. We still really appreciate everyone who helped us out on Patreon, who was part of our after shows and all of those things. And it really helped us get the show off the ground. And yeah, we're just very, very happy to have done that, even though we didn't end up reaching those goals that we had.
Absolutely.
But let's get to it. Let's do this first episode. We have a lot of great things lined up here. And we need to, of course, start with the Rambo Report. So, Rambo, what have you found recently during your spelunking?
Chestnuts.
Chestnuts? The kinds that you eat or some other kinds?
That's another kind of chestnut.
Interesting. What can that be then?
Well, so as usual, whenever a new version of iOS comes out, I go and look at it and see what's changed from the previous version. Differently from other people who do this, I don't install the OS and go looking. I actually look at what's changed inside the OS. I take it apart before actually using it. So I found something new in not only in Springboard, but in other places as well. And lots of classes related to chestnut, like chestnut controller or something. And first of all, that naming. Apple manages to surprise me still with their naming. And I always find some funny names of variables and methods and classes and stuff, and that's what I usually post on Twitter, and people seem to enjoy that, so I'll keep doing it.
Yeah, especially the method names can be really, really funny, right?
Yeah.
Like, especially the ones that are like, you know, here be dragons, or, you know, if you call this, you will be fired, or something like that. Like,
yes.
These method names are really, really funny.
That's why I find it so funny, because I also do this in my code. I like to do funny naming of things, like cuteness core. And one I posted yesterday, which I think is a method called has tickled tab bar icons, something like that.
Yeah.
And so and since I have this habit, it's funny to see that Apple engineers also do this.
Do you think that these names, like chestnut controller, is what they actually use when they write the code? Or do you think they have some kind of, you know, what would you call it, like a shimming layer, or like some kind of macros or compiler step that will actually, you know, turn those symbol names into chestnut so that they can use the real names when they're working? Or are they actually doing like chestnut controller dot, you know, blah, blah, blah?
Yeah, I heard from people inside Apple that it depends, really. Sometimes they do use macros. So for those who don't know, basically when you're writing C code or Objective-C code, which is just C, you can give something a name that's just like an alias for the real name. And then it basically changes at compile time. So when you compile your program, it changes the name. So you can call it, this is the window controller something, and it renames it to chestnut or something.
Yeah.
So you can do that, and it obviously makes writing the code easier.
Right, that's what I'm thinking.
I don't know if it's the case here. I'm not sure if the weird name is just a way to obfuscate what this does, or if it's just like a funny name that someone came up with.
Yeah, it can also be like the project name, right? Because that's something that we used a lot when I worked at Spotify, for example, when we, like, the final name of the feature, like the marketing name wasn't really decided, but we had like a project name. So we were using the project name as the kind of, you know, prefix for all the classes. So it could be something like this here, where it's like Chestnut Controller, which is the Chestnut feature, and it would just be called that in code internally as a code name, but then the kind of marketing name or the public-facing name will obviously be different.
Yeah, like Animoji is Avatar Kit.
Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah, that's a great example.
It's not Animoji Kit, it's Avatar Kit, because that's the code name for it. And Apple uses code names a lot, and every tech company, to some extent, uses at least like temporary feature names for features that aren't released yet, and then the marketing team comes up with the actual name for the feature.
Right, the crack marketing team, they go on their offsite into the Himalayas or something.
The VW minibus. Yeah,
exactly. And then they come up with Animoji, which is a really great name.
Yeah, I love it.
But back to Chestnut. What is Chestnut?
All right, so back to Chestnut. China stuff.
Right.
Yeah. So basically, recently Apple had to change the way some things work on iOS in China because of patent claims by Qualcomm. And we're not going to go into detail here because we don't talk about that stuff in StackTrace. It's just the tech stuff. So the tech side of things is that they had to issue an update of iOS, which I believe was 12.1.2. And it changed the, I think it was the app killing animation on iPhone 10 and up, and something about the contact card UI, something like that. So, and from what I could understand from this Chestnut stuff is that they have basically made like remote feature switches so they can disable this functionality remotely if they want to.
So once they win the lawsuit or something, they can just toggle this off and return the UI to its former glory.
Yeah, so maybe the class name is like Qualcomm Lawsuit Controller, something like that.
Yeah.
So that's basically what it is, and it downloads like a plist file from Apple servers, and even the plist file is like obfuscated. It's just like key 1 and key 2. There are no like real names for the keys, but they are just two values which are either yes or no, and it's basically just toggling the change on and off. That's it.
Huh, interesting. It kind of makes you wonder how many of these things for different markets and different conditions like exist all over the operating system. Because I'm sure this is not the first time where, you know, Apple, they get sued all the time, right? There's fights all the time between these big tech companies about all kinds of stuff. And it would just be interesting to kind of see a full list of all these different conditions that they have in order to comply with not only for lawsuits and things like that, but to comply with like local laws and rules and things like that. And I'm sure there's like so much complication in the OS that, you know, is not really visible for a lot of people, but exists there under the hood to do all these different things.
Yeah, I actually plan on doing something like that maybe for Rambo.codes, going into iOS and finding like every single place where there's a special if for some specific market, and there are lots of them, like especially for China, which is such a like a different market from everywhere else. There's a famous one, which is like the Apple Watch Pride face is not available in Russia because it's basically illegal there, which is kind of ridiculous, but Apple has no choice, basically. Yeah. If they want to trade in Russia, they have to follow the regulations there. And that's a discussion that came up in many other places, like at which point Apple just says, no, I'm not going to do this. I'm just going to get out of this market. But it's not a discussion for StackTrace.
No, we like to stick to the technical stuff, even though politics are important, but there are so many other places to get your politics fix on if that's what you're looking for.
Yeah. So that's Chestnut, and we think you're gonna love it.
Yeah, for sure, if you're in China. So what else have you found? Like, have you been spelunking iOS 12.2, anything?
Yes, 12.2 was a great release. First of all, for us developers, Xcode 10.2 comes with Swift 5.
Yeah, that's super exciting.
That's very exciting. So I made a post on 9to5, which is about how your apps are going to get smaller, potentially on iOS 12.2 and up. Because explaining in a simple way, basically, Swift, it has been changing a lot since its first version in 2014 or something. And that means that if you release an app that's built with Swift 3, it needs the runtime for Swift 3 embedded in the app.
In every single app, yeah.
Every single app, yeah. So Apple does not ship Swift 3 inside iOS or macOS or watchOS, etc. So basically, that means that every Swift app in the App Store is approximately 8 megabytes larger because of that. So that changes a little bit depending on the features the app uses. So it's not exact. So some apps are a little bit less and some are a little bit more. I've seen like apps which have like 14 megabytes of Swift libraries, for instance. So it can add a lot of weight to the app.
Yeah, it also depends if you have a watch app embedded in your app, then you have to embed a second set of Swift libraries in there. And the main reason Swift 5 is kind of fixing this problem is because now with Swift 5, Swift is ABI stable. So the application binary interface is from now on going to be the same, even though Swift will go through like new major versions like 6, 7, 8, etc. The main binary interface will stay the same. It's been stabilized. And that way, Apple can ship the Swift libraries, like the standard library and the runtime and all those things, in the actual operating system so that all third-party apps don't have to re-embed the same or very similar set of libraries in every single app. They can instead link directly to the system libraries safely. Even though the app might be using like Swift 6 or something, but the OS might still be using Swift 5, it's fine because, you know, the ABI will be the same.
They basically speak the same language.
Yeah, exactly. That was a good way of putting it.
Yeah, so, and there's another advantage, which is that the frameworks that ship with iOS or and watchOS, they come in a bundle, which is the DLD cache, and that's shared memory space between all processes. So what that means is that when you launch the app, it's not going to have to go to disk and read every single Swift library the app uses. So right, that's going to make apps launch faster as well.
Yeah, that's perfect. And also consume less memory, right? Because they can all just point directly to that shared memory space instead of having to have their own instance in memory as part of the app.
Another interesting thing I noticed while doing some research for the article, I downloaded some apps from the App Store to do some simulations of what type of space savings we were talking about. And I noticed that, and I specifically downloaded some apps that I knew had watch apps, because those are like the worst case scenario. And I noticed that many developers had the same realization I had when I made the watch app for the company I work for, which is that basically, it's rough. Like, if you have a Swift app and you want to add a watch app, the entire app becomes a lot larger.
Yeah.
And it also like makes deployment during development super slow, because you have to be uploading the entire app to your Apple Watch for debugging, and that takes a long time. So what many developers, including myself, decided to do was to just not use Swift for their watch apps and do them in Objective-C. I noticed that I thought it was something that I had done, but many people also did the same. There are many Swift apps in the App Store that have watch apps which are written in Objective-C for this exact reason.
Yeah, exactly. I talked to Ben Sandowski of Halide on the last episode of Swift by Sundell, and he mentioned the exact same thing, that he actually rewrote the watch app in Objective-C for that reason, because even though the main app was Swift, it was just like, it's too much to add all that extra kind of cruft into the app, because you have to embed those two set of Swift libraries, and you know, writing the watch app in Objective-C, because it's probably a very, very simple app anyway. You could still have a majority of your app in Swift, but just have one set of libraries.
Exactly. So yeah, so iOS 12.2 is going to make your apps smaller and they will launch faster. And also developers will be able to write watchOS apps in Swift practically.
Yeah, that's super exciting. So what else have you found? Any traces of new hardware maybe?
Yes, a friend of the show, Steve Troughton-Smith, found references to new iPad models and the new iPod Touch even.
That's super fascinating.
Can you believe that?
Yeah.
iPod Touch?
I'm starting to think, like, I've been thinking about this for a couple of days about the iPod Touch and how it kind of could fit into the whole picture.
What's an iPod?
Yeah, exactly. I'm starting to think that, you know, the iPod Touch is very similar to the iPad in many ways. And maybe, like, there's rumors of a new iPad Mini. And if you say that you would make an iPod Touch version of, like, the iPhone X or even the iPhone XS Max, it would kind of be almost like an iPad Mini at that point. So I'm starting to think that maybe there's going to be like an iPad Mini and then maybe an iPad like Micro or iPad Nano, and that's the new iPod Touch. Do you think that would kind of make sense? Because for me, like, the word iPod has kind of started to fade out a little bit from just, like, you know, being relevant. And that's kind of sad because the iPod was amazing and was a huge, huge product. But if you look at the current lineup, there's nothing really saying anything about iPods there. So having just this one product called iPod Touch would be kind of weird, I think. So I'm starting to think that maybe it's going to be like more like an iPad Nano. What do you think about that?
Maybe they should just release an iPhone without the phone and just call it i.
Or iPhone minus.
Yeah, so That's interesting. The naming aspect is really interesting because, yeah, it is kind of weird to have just this one product which has iPod.
Yeah, it's super strange, especially since it functionally will be pretty much like an iPad. Like an iPad without cellular connectivity.
Like an iPad Nano.
Exactly, like an iPad Nano. I give Apple full permission to use that name. I won't claim any royalties.
Oh yeah. Yeah, so it is interesting, but at the same time it's iPods 8, something, I think, the identifier. So it's definitely an iPod.
Right. And yeah, that's also super interesting.
Yeah, so and by the way, the iPad rumor is stronger than the iPod one, and I'll explain. Basically, there are two types of identifiers products have. There are more than two, but in this case, I'm going to explain two of them. There's the name of product something, something, which is like iPhone 11, 6, which is the iPhone XS Max, for instance. And then there's the internal model identifier, which is like D33 for the iPhone XS Max, and the iPad Pro is J320. That's a more like concrete model number, because that's the actual model number that's burned into the device, and that actually means it's a device that's going to ship.
Yeah,
if you know what I mean. So finding just iPods 9, something, I don't remember the exact identifier, doesn't necessarily mean there's a new iPod coming.
Right.
But finding like a new identifier like we found for iPad, which is, I think, J210, that's more concrete. That means there is actually an iPad coming.
Right, because that means that that identifier will be used in all the internal systems. For example, what you found, you know, originally with the iPhone X, the glyph was called D22, right?
Yeah.
So all those internal systems are using those D, or like that letter plus number kind of identifier, rather than the iPod something something or iPad something.
Yeah, exactly. And also it means it's an actual product for customers and not a prototype, because
right,
prototypes are usually like T something, T320, T whatever. So being J something means it's like a real product for customers. And the new iPad Pros are J3 something. They were referenced in code as J3XX because J3 and two other numbers.
Yeah.
And the new iPads, which are probably coming in March, are J2 something, J210, J217. I think there are four identifiers there.
And does the two there signify that it's a non-Pro iPad?
Not necessarily. Like, the numbers don't really mean much. They are pretty random. So, yeah, I wouldn't read too much into them.
Okay. Cool. Yeah, but this rumor for me is pretty exciting. I think there's a ton of use cases for iOS devices that are currently kind of not really there when it comes to, like, imagine having a very much wider range of iOS devices that are not these kind of high-end phones or something like that. But take the low-cost iPad, for example. I think it's a great example where that can be deployed in schools. You know, it can be used in shops. And, you know, I see a lot of people using iPads now as their kind of, you know, point-of-sale system in smaller shops and things like that. And yep. I think even having smaller devices like that, like this new iPod Touch, for example, or a smaller iPad model, would also be super, you know, useful in those use cases where it will probably cost less. You know, the screen is smaller, the device is smaller, it's more portable. So I think there's a ton of use cases there for these, like, lower cost, simpler iOS devices that can be plugged into all sorts of things and also maybe used, you know, for automation or, you know, in buildings or for construction sites. You know, there's all kinds of these use cases where you basically just need a screen and then you write custom software for it or you plug something into it. And having these devices available, I think, could be super powerful in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, like, I can mention the case of the company I work for, which it involves a establishment like a restaurant, and the customer comes with a coupon on the app, and we have an app for Android that the restaurants can use to scan the coupon and, like, talk to our system and, like, redeem the coupon automatically. But there's no app for iOS because, like, basically no restaurant in Brazil, unless, like, it's a super expensive fancy restaurant, has money to have, like, a dedicated iOS device for each waiter to, like, do the redeem process.
Yeah,
that's nuts. Like, that's impossible here. So some of them have Android devices, and that's what they use. Most of them actually use a computer with a barcode scanner attached to it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot of things to be said about that market, and ensure that Apple will probably not be able to go as low in price as, you know, some of these really low-end Android devices that you see people use in these cases. But it would still be interesting, kind of like, you know, how we now are super excited that the Mac Mini is back, because there's so many cases covered by the Mac Mini as a home server, or, you know, as a build server, or whichever way you want to use it. And I think the same thing can be said about a smaller, lower cost iOS device, whatever shape or form it takes, that you can use, you know, in many of these use cases where you don't need, like, a full blown phone. It's not like your own device. It's more like something you use for work.
Exactly. So there's been a lot of talk lately about Apple and services. They have been moving more towards services. They highlight the numbers for services in their earnings calls. And currently they have, like, iCloud and Apple Music and stuff like that, and Apple News, but it's, like, free for now. And there's been some talk about Apple releasing new services, like an original video content service, even like a gaming subscription service. And another one is a magazine subscription service for Apple News, like an Apple News subscription that would also give you access to magazines. And I found that on iOS 12.2. They didn't hide it.
Oh, really? It's there in plain sight?
Not plain sight.
In plain sight for Rambo. In Rambo sight.
In Rambo, yeah. Exactly. So what I found was a launch screen, like a landing page for their internal seed of the Apple News Magazine service, which was not redacted from the simulator build of Apple News.
Huh, that's super interesting.
Yeah, so it's like a landing page and it shows like Apple News Magazine's internal seeds, and there's like there are some magazine covers in there. Those could be like placeholders, but I don't think they would like take magazines at random and just put them there if they weren't be part of the service, even when it's just like an internal test. I don't think they would risk that. So you can see Vogue and ESPN and some other magazines in there. And yeah, so basically that's confirmed, like Apple is working on an Apple News subscription, which will include magazines.
Nice. And do you think that the reason that they made it like a public facing thing sort of, or like a Rambo facing thing, is because they need like the people working at these magazines at Vogue, ESPN, etc. to actually test this, so that they could, for example, for their iCloud account, flip a feature flag and, you know, even though they're using the public facing version of iOS 12.2, not some specific internal build, they would still see it, and that the feed is there and everything. So it's kind of like, you know, when the HomePod, it had this like HomePod try at home program for employees, like there was a bunch of URLs that you found that were exposed publicly to work in that context. Is this something similar here, you think?
Yeah, I think it's possible that since they are testing this with employees that are not necessarily running internal builds of iOS, it is possible that that to be the case, or even like partners which yeah. need to test stuff. Yeah, I believe that's a possibility.
Yeah, because you can really, really see that workflow where, you know, someone at Vogue needs to kind of approve how it looks inside of Apple News, right? So it's not just like Apple can just do it, you know, secretively in their own, you know, kind of sphere. They need to have that, you know, back and forth with the people at the magazine. So that would require them to open certain things up publicly.
Yeah. And there are also some references to a bundle subscription in there.
All right, so now we're talking about bundling different magazines together, or do you think it's even bigger, like a bundle of Apple News and Apple Music and Apple Video that other people have been speculating a lot about?
Yeah, I'm not completely sure, to be honest. It could be just like they are calling it a bundle because it bundles several magazines into one subscription. But I've seen some references to bundle subscription outside of stuff directly connected to Apple News. So yeah, it could be either one of those. But I really think that when they announce like the magazine stuff, the video stuff, and maybe the gaming stuff, I really don't think they would not offer like an Apple bundle subscription that covers everything.
Yeah, like Apple Prime, as some people have been calling it, right? Like yeah. a kind of an all-you-can-eat kind of bundle. And yeah, I think that makes total sense because, yeah, a lot of people also, myself included, actually, like wants to simplify things. Like you don't want to have all these different subscriptions. So if you can just have one kind of invoice coming from Apple in this case, that would be super convenient.
Yep. So yeah, we will see. I really feel like this is all that we've been seeing with 12.2 is kind of pointing towards a March event.
Oh, okay. Because there's so many things kind of cooking, like so many things going on that, you know, we need to have an event soon. Is that what you're thinking? Or have you seen any late March identifiers in code?
No, not that, but like we are currently in approaching mid-February and we are in beta 2, I think. Yeah, I think we're still only beta 2 of 12.2. So let's say they start doing weekly betas from now. We'll have beta 3 next week, 4 the other, 5, and maybe we would have 6 the other. That's not like an amazing number of betas. That's like a normal number of betas. And so I could definitely see them doing like an event in the first week of March, maybe the second week of March, which will release iOS 12.2, and the GM version of iOS 12.2 would have like support for AirPower and would include the magazine stuff fully open to everyone, and maybe the new video stuff and the support for the new devices. And then they announced the new iPads, the new iPod Touch, new AirPods, finally release AirPower, the new subscriptions. I think that's more than enough for an event.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it makes sense also for that event to be more focused around the services and the subscriptions, because that's also a narrative that Apple has been, you know, really, really pushing a lot, especially in their kind of investor calls and things like that, that they're focusing so much on subscription revenue, services revenue. So I think it would make total sense to have like an event that is not so much focused on hardware, even though we might see these new iPad models and things like that, but more focused around like, here's our video service, here's this new magazine service, and lots of other things kind of related to that.
Yeah, and there's going to be so much software stuff for WWDC that I don't think they would have time for services there.
I think they also kind of learned from the mistake of introducing Apple Music at a developer conference.
Yeah, that developers don't really like it.
Right, exactly. Developers want to see the new cool APIs, right? Like, you know, talk about Swift. Don't talk about, talk about that Swift, not Taylor Swift, right?
Exactly. So speaking of AirPods, there's also a new setup screen for you to train Hey for AirPods.
Oh, that's awesome.
And oh my god, I just say the phrase here.
And the whole apartment kind of lights up.
Yeah.
And Siri is at your service.
Yeah, we'll bleep that in the edit.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, so you can set up the secret phrase and it's very clear. It says, like, you can say "Hey Dingus" to your AirPods or to your iPhone.
And so, that will work with the current version of AirPods, you think? Or are we talking about like a new version?
Yeah, that'll definitely require new hardware in the AirPods to do the actual recognition.
Right. Yeah, that's a feature that I actually would like more and more in the AirPods. I've found myself shouting, "Hey Dingus," across the room, because usually what I do is that if I like do the dishes or do some cleaning or something, I leave the iPhone on like my desk, and then I walk around the apartment with the AirPods. And it's actually pretty remarkable how good the range is. I don't have a huge apartment, it's actually pretty small, but still it can pretty much reach my entire apartment with the AirPods, as long as I like have the iPhone on my desk, which has a pretty clear line of sight. That's pretty cool. And of course, like sometimes when I'm doing the dishes or something, I come up with an idea and I want to make a note of it or make a reminder, and then I just scream really loud because I don't have a HomePod.
Yeah, or you just want to like raise the volume or something.
Right.
And the current AirPods doesn't offer like volume control, but maybe the new ones will.
Yeah, maybe you can like swipe up and down. But yeah, so I would love "Hey" or "Hey Dingus" on on the AirPods as well. That would be awesome.
Yeah, so that's very possible, since I found this clear UI that's made to train the AirPods to your voice, just like you do it with your iPhone. And it's clearly made to be used during the first setup of your AirPods when you pair them to your iPhone. There's the little sheet that pops up and you can set it up there, and it's going to have an extra step for setting up the voice trigger system. That's what it's called.
That's really cool. Nice. All right, let's talk more in detail about AirPods, because you've been doing something really interesting with AirPods with a new app that you've been launching. But before we do, let's take a very quick break and thank our first sponsor, which is super exciting. And it's our good friends at Mac Stadium. Now, you've probably heard us talk about Mac Stadium on this podcast before, because Rambo is using it for a bunch of different services, including ShareCuts. But Mac Stadium, they're the leading provider of enterprise-grade Mac infrastructure. They provide scalable, reliable, and secure private clouds and dedicated servers for workloads that require macOS. Now, you might not only have heard about them here on Stacktrace before, but you might have also seen when they got a shout out from Apple during their last keynote announcing the new Mac Mini. So whether you need a single Mac Mini or a fully scalable Mac private cloud, Mac Stadium can help you move your iOS and Mac app development out from under your desk and into the cloud. You can scale from a single Mac to thousands very, very easily. They currently have over 8,000 Mac minis racked in their data centers. You can work with experts to create your perfect cloud, and they already work with really big companies like Capital One, Box, Shopify, Pandora, and many, many more. The great thing about using Mac Stadium is that you can really reduce your costs if you compare it to kind of these do-it-yourself solutions. Now, Rambo, you've been using Mac Stadium for quite a while for share cuts and for other things. So what is it about Mac Stadium that you really, really like?
I mean, it's so cool to have your own Mac Mini on the cloud. That's all yours. It's almost like you grab a Mac Mini and drop it off at their data center and they just plug the cable in and you're online. So you can do many things. What I do with my Mac Mini is I host Sharecuts, sharecuts.app. You can visit right now. So it's a Swift on the server project. And since it's dealing with shortcuts from the Shortcuts app, it has to deal with the Shortcuts file format, which is a binary property list. And so I needed to use like the property list support on macOS to make like the integration with the Shortcuts more seamless. And you could do that in a Linux machine, but it would be like a little bit hacky, and I already knew about Mac Stadium, so I decided to give them a go. And yeah, I'm very happy about it. And the setup is very easy. I've even went through like a macOS updates, and it was super simple to do. There's not much management you end up having to do with your Mac Mini.
Yeah, it's super cool that you can like take your own Mac Mini and can put it in the cloud, and you can just access it from anywhere. I think it's a really, really cool idea. And it's really awesome also if you want to use macOS also for your server-side development now, also with things like server-side Swift, which you are using for Sharecuts.
Yeah, and we have also the little splash page for Splash, your project. You can visit splash.rambo.codes, and it actually uses things like Core Graphics and NapKit to render a attributed string on the server and make it into a PNG image you can download, which is super fun.
Yeah, it's super awesome, because one thing with server-side Swift sometimes is that you're not able to use all of those kind of foundation frameworks and those things that you would find on macOS. But when you have your server running on Mac hardware, you can use, like you say, you can use Core Graphics, and you can use all of these tools that you're used to, even on server-side, which is pretty amazing. So if you're building apps for the Apple ecosystem, or if you know a team that is, you can learn more about Mac Stadium's infrastructure at macstadium.com/stacktrace. And we have a special offer also for all of our awesome listeners, and that is that Mac Stadium, they're offering 2 months for the price of one on a Mac Mini subscription. All you have to do is go to macstadium.com/stacktrace and enter promo code 9to5Mac when you order. So once again, that's macstadium.com/stacktrace and promo code 9to5Mac to get 2 months for the price of one on a Mac Mini subscription. Thank you so much to Mac Stadium for sponsoring Stacktrace. All right, so you've been busy lately, Rambo. You've launched a brand new app, which... You know, I have a new marketing line for your new app, which is called AirBuddy, by the way. But you know what the new marketing line I have for you is?
Tell me.
It made John Sundell update to macOS Mojave.
Well, it's the second John it makes update to Mojave.
All right. Who's the other one?
John Gruber.
Oh, okay. Well, he wins.
Yeah. Yeah. I was chatting to him about the app, and he was like, oh, I haven't updated to Mojave yet. I might as well do it now.
That's literally what I did. Like, I came home from my vacation, and I was like, oh, I got to try AirBuddy. I was like, oh, right, I need to update to Mojave. But for me, it's like, you know, I've been prompted in macOS so many times, like every single day almost, update to Mojave. And I'm always extremely conservative with these macOS updates, not because I think they're bad or anything, but the Mac for me is just like, you know, it's this workhorse, this like tool that I just need to do all of my work. And I do so many things and I don't have time for anything to go wrong, and I have everything set up. So usually I'm very conservative with these updates, but you know, I needed to try AirBuddy because it looks so cool. And so yeah, I updated as soon as I came back, and I've been using it since, and it is awesome. AirBuddy, that is. Mojave is like, okay, it's macOS, but AirBuddy is awesome.
You're one of those iPad people.
I'm becoming an iPad person more and more every single day, I feel like. I mean, I still love the Mac, but yeah, we'll save that for a future episode. But yeah, the iPad, it's taking me over. So first of all, for those who hasn't used AirBuddy yet, what is it, Rambo? Can you give us kind of the elevator pitch for the app?
It's an app that makes you update to Mojave.
Nice.
It keeps begging. No, AirBuddy is AirPods on the Mac like they've always should have been. Basically, that's it. So when you have AirPods, as you know, you open them up next to your iPhone and a beautiful interface with the 3D spinning AirPods shows up and it gives you the battery status and you have a widget with the battery for your AirPods and your other nearby devices. And there's nothing like that on the Mac. The underlying system that powers that stuff is on the Mac though. So I thought, what if someone would actually make a UI for this stuff, which macOS already has, but has no UI for. So that's AirBuddy. That's basically doing Apple's work for them.
That's super nice. And the cool thing is that it does feel extremely native. Like, it does feel like you say, like, this is how AirPods should have worked in the first place. Because on iOS, you have this like super elegant experience of you open up the AirPods case, you have your iPhone nearby, this super nice animation pops up, everything is very seamless, you just pair very easily. But on the Mac, you have to go to the Bluetooth menu, you have to like connect, and sometimes it doesn't work as well and things like that. But now with AirBuddy, it brings that same experience, because not only have you been inspired by that dialogue, you're actually using the exact same assets, right?
Yeah, exactly. So iOS downloads those assets on demand. It actually ships with some of them, but they can be downloaded on demand from Apple servers. And AirBuddy does the same thing. So it uses the same feed that iOS does. It's not like a private feed or anything. It's just like a feed on Apple servers that has those assets in there. And it's the same feed used for AirPower, by the way. There are the same assets, so it looks pretty much the same. But I did add one more feature to the status window, which is a button called Click to Connect.
Click to Connect.
Which is missing from iOS.
Right. So that's like when your AirPods are not paired with the current Mac, you can click to connect and it will start the pairing process?
Yeah, not if they're not paired. If they're not connected to your Mac, you can just click to connect. Because if you just open the case, it's not going to connect to your Mac automatically if it wasn't already connected to your Mac. It's going to connect to the last device it was connected to, like, let's say, your iPhone.
Right.
So...
Yeah, that's what I mean with pairing, because that's how it works. Like in the kind of classic Bluetooth world, is that my Bluetooth headphones that I have, which are not AirPods, I have AirPods too, but the ones that I use, which are over my ears, they work that way, that I have to pair with the new device. Like if I want to go to the Mac, I have to pair them to the Mac. I have to go and pair them to the iPhone.
Yeah, I avoid using the word pairing because pairing for W1 devices means a completely different thing.
Right, okay.
So pairing is like when the device is brand new out of the box, or if you hold the button for a long time, it enters pairing mode. And that's when you actually enroll the device with your iCloud account. And that's pairing for W1 devices.
Yeah, that's that like magic sauce that they have sprinkled on top of Bluetooth, right? Because
exactly.
These devices are using Bluetooth, but with that extra layer using iCloud.
Yeah, so and that's why with AirBuddy, you can't use your AirPods with your Mac if your Mac is not connected to the same iCloud account that's been used to pair the AirPods originally. I've had some people who had that issue. Apparently, a considerable amount of people don't use iCloud on the Mac for some reason. They are not logged into iCloud on the Mac. And yeah, that's an issue, because then the system doesn't recognize those AirPods as yours.
Right.
And on iOS, when you do that, you open up the AirPods next to a device that's not yours. It shows like not your AirPods. But I decided to just not implement that because I thought it could be annoying.
Yeah. So can you take us through like the journey of building this app? So not only was it like actually building the UI, building the app itself, but you had to constantly kind of throughout the process go deeper and deeper into the kind of spelunking rabbit hole where, like, we were talking and you went through a lot of different iterations where, let me use this API and then, oh, wait a second, I can actually use this more kind of higher level or lower level version of the same API and gain more access or do it easier. So can you kind of tell this kind of story of how you made it through and how you kind of reached this implementation that you're currently using?
Yeah, so the initial implementation, I was using an API which required special entitlements. And I wasn't sure if it was possible at all to do it without the need for special entitlements, that which is the main reason why initially this was going to be just something I made for myself. It wasn't going to be a product at all. Like, I wasn't going to release it. I would maybe release it as open source, just if for me and other people who have like AMFI get out of my way enabled.
Another one of those funny names.
Yeah, and we talked about that in a previous episode, what that means. Yeah. Basically, jailbreak your Mac and you can use it. So the first iteration was that. But then I went looking and I found like the API that the API I was using was using. So like the more lower level API, which was not that low level, it was just like one layer of abstraction down from the API I was using. And that one did not require special entitlements. So then that was the moment when I noticed that this could be feasible as like something I could release.
Yeah, because you didn't want the kind of first user experience to be like, hey, welcome to AirBuddy. Please disable all system integrity protection and everything in order for this to work.
Disable system integrity protection, add this boot argument to the kernel,
exactly.
And reboot your Mac in recovery mode.
It's basically plug and play.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I love about it because, again, it feels extremely native where you just download it, you launch it for the first time, it starts running this background process, and then it just works. Like, you don't need to leave it running. You can just open up your AirPods and, you know, the dialogue pops up.
Yeah, and so the knowledge that made it possible, it's knowledge I've been accumulating for many, many years. Like, just from looking at iOS and how that stuff works, I ended up like knowing a lot about how this works under the hood, and that's what made it possible. Like, the actual development was fairly quick, didn't take me too long, but coming to the point where I know how this stuff works and being able to reverse engineer headers from private frameworks and stuff, that took me a long time.
So this is a super interesting product, not only from kind of a technical perspective that you were able to kind of use those same underlying foundational frameworks that Apple is using on iOS, also existed on the Mac, and build a UI on top of it. But you've also built like a native Mac app, which is not something that a lot of companies do these days. You know, we see more and more of these kind of hybrid solutions with Electron that, you know, I know what you think about that. So what's it like kind of like building and launching a brand new Mac app in 2019?
Well, I don't think it's changed that much. Basically, you have two options. You have the Mac App Store and you have the direct route. And for this app, I had no choice. I had to release it directly because it uses private API and it shows images of Apple products, which they would never allow in the Mac App Store. So there was basically no thinking about it. The only thing I did differently this time was that I decided to, instead of like, because even though this is a product, it's not like there's a difference between you launching something cool and for people to enjoy and make a little bit of money out of it, and you actually like building a business out of something.
Yeah.
This is not an app that I'm planning on building a business around because I don't think it's a sustainable product to be like the basis of an entire business, because maybe this year Apple adds this stuff to macOS and
yeah,
then there's no need for AirBuddy anymore. And I'll be more than happy to not have to maintain it anymore.
The classic Sherlocking, right?
Exactly. So I decided to just release it on Gumroad, which is this cool website. They are like focused on indie stuff, artists and writers and software developers. So you can just put a product page up really simple, and they do the payouts through PayPal, and you just set up the page how you want it, give your software to them. They have some copy protection stuff they can do as well. And that's it. So very, very simple, very straightforward, and direct to customers through my developer ID.
Nice. And on Gumroad, you've chosen a pretty interesting pricing model, which is that the app costs $5, but you can pay whatever you want. So if you want to do what I did, which is, you know, give you more, then you can do that, which I think is pretty cool. I haven't seen a lot of apps doing that recently where, you know, you can basically say, hey, if you like my work, you can support me by, you know, giving me a few extra dollars. So how's that model kind of been working out for you? And have you gotten some good feedback from that model?
Yeah, so I was thinking about the price, and I thought initially I was going to make it 10. So, but I decided to make it 5 because, not because I thought 10 was too expensive, it's not at all in my opinion, but more because I wanted more people to be able to have it. And I think 5 is a lot more accessible. So I decided to make it 5, but Gumroad does offer this pay what you want model. You can even put like the minimum as 0, and if people don't want to pay anything, they don't have to. I decided to leave the pricing open, starting at 5, and if people want to give a little bit more, they can. And yeah, quite a bit of people have been doing that, actually. I've seen, like, from what I've seen, I haven't like looked into it too much, but most people who gave more than 5 gave 10, I think, because it's like a
double, yeah,
nice round number. It's double, so it feels good, like, to be paying double. So yeah, most people who gave more gave 10. Some people gave like 50, not many, but some people did. And so that's it. So it does work. You do make more money. Like, it's like, if many people give 10, it's like I sold like double the number of copies for those copies that paid 10. So it's a good model. I think it's worth it. Like, if I were to be making a business out of this, I would not be making it like a paid upfront app. I don't think that model works anymore. Because with a paid app, what you get is you get a huge spike of sales at launch. If the launch is successful, maybe you don't even get that. and then it just drops like completely after like 2 or 3 days, and it kind of stabilizes, and sometimes it like goes to 0 after a while. Right. But I would be totally happy with this scenario for everybody, because that was my goal. To like get this spike and pay for development and maybe make a little bit more all of it, but that's it. Like, it doesn't have to sustain me. It's not a business. It's just like something that people liked and that I wanted people to have access to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the pay what you want pricing model works also really great if you are someone who is doing a lot of other stuff that people might be enjoying, like this podcast, you know, all your spelunking things, your writing and things like that, that people might want to support, you know, because they are not paying this money to some big corporation. They're paying it directly to you, right? And I think that can be really, really powerful when, you know, people have the opportunity to support you and to, you know, give you a couple of extra bucks, and hopefully that will also motivate you to build new tools like this. So I think that could be really, really great, because with pricing, it's always really difficult. Like you say, you don't want to overprice, because that would only enable a certain group of people to buy your product. But at the same time, you don't want to underprice either. So you don't want to say, well, it's only $5 and that's it. Because the fact is that the people who do want to support you, you know, they might, you know, want to pay you more. How can they do that? So I think this model kind of provides the best out of both worlds, and it's definitely something that I'm now considering, for example, for my upcoming book, where I might be able to like set the price like slightly lower than what I might have done otherwise, but then have like, you know, a pay what you want model where, you know, if some people enjoy my work and enjoy my articles and they want to, you know, buy me an extra cup of coffee or something, they can. So I think it's a really interesting pricing model that, you know, I also want to experiment with it.
Yeah, I think for individuals, like you mentioned, it's very worth it trying out this model, especially if you have like some amount of following online and you have some people who like the stuff you do. I think it's definitely a model that can work. Like I've had people tell me that they bought it and they don't even have AirPods, and some of them can't even run the app because they haven't upgraded to Mojave, but they bought the app just to support my work, which is lovely.
Yeah, it really, really is. Because, you know, one thing that I always say about this stuff, like about monetization, about pricing and things like that, is like, you know, my personal goal, it's just to be able to keep doing what I'm doing. Like with the sponsorships that I'm doing, with the book that I'm doing, like the money that I get from that, I just want to use that money to do even more stuff, you know? And I think that's true for many, many indies. And we'll talk about being indie in a second, where our goal is not to like, you know, become super rich of this Airbuddy app, you know, that's not very likely, but just to be able to get in enough funding to actually do the next thing and then the next thing, because our passion is to build things and we just want to keep doing that. So I think something like this also helps us to get more kind of this kind of funding for the people who want to help contribute to, you know, be able to do even cooler things in the future.
Exactly.
Cool. So speaking about AirPods and cool things, we have one final topic for this episode, which is about being indie, because I've now been indie for a little bit more than a month. You're about to go indie, which is super exciting. So we want to talk a little bit about that. But before we do, let's thank our second and final sponsor for this episode, which is Hyper. Hyper is the company behind some really great USB-C hubs, chargers, battery packs, and other high-quality accessories for Apple devices. This month, 9to5 Mac has teamed up with Hyper to create a deal of the month where we'll feature really great deals on high-quality accessories for Apple devices. And for February, you can get the new Hyperjuice wireless charger for Apple's AirPods for just $20, which is down from the usual $50 price tag. Now, this is the new and improved second generation of Hyper's wireless charging case, which features a fully enclosing design and other great improvements. The cool thing is that you just take your original Apple AirPods charging case and you put it inside the Hyperjuice, great name by the way, and they can wirelessly charge your AirPods with using any Qi charger of 5 watts and above. Now, the cool thing is that this case has a design that is just the same as the original case that comes with the AirPods, so it matches this really nice. And you can charge the Apple AirPods case back to full in just 1.5 hours, and you got this nice little green LED light as well. So what do you think about this product, Rambo? It's pretty cool, right? That they have created this wireless charging case, which, you know, it's kind of, when you use it on a Qi charger, it kind of looks a little bit like AirPower.
Well, first of all, the name is awesome. Like Hyperjuice. I love that name.
Yeah.
And second, like, isn't it interesting that Hyper has been able to release a wireless charging case for AirPods before Apple?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so because of the whole AirPower thing, Apple hasn't released a wireless charging case yet. But yeah, with Hyper, you can get like they are focused on making like good quality products, and it's like to Apple fans who like quality, well-made products. That's like who Hyper is trying to make happy here, and the Hyperjuice is definitely a very interesting product. And yeah, you don't have to wait for AirPower anymore, just get the Hyperjuice case.
Yeah, Hyper has a really kind of long history of augmenting a lot of these Apple devices. Like when the MacBook One came out, they had this dock which added all these ports, and now they've got this you know, great wireless charging case. I just started using wireless charging and it's so great. Like it's still like magic to me. So I think this case looks really, really awesome. So how do you get this great deal? Well, the only thing you need to do is you need to open up the show notes for this episode. So in your podcast player that you're listening to right now, open up our show notes where you can find all the links from this episode. And you can also find this great deal, which is that you can get the Hyperjuice wireless charging case for AirPods for 60% off. That's really a great deal, making it just $20 for our lovely listeners of Stacktrace. So make sure to check that out. Once again, just open up the show notes, check out the deal for Hyper's Hyperjuice wireless charger. Thank you so much to Hyper for sponsoring this episode of Stacktrace. All right, so for our last topic of this episode, we want to talk a little bit about going indie, because that's something that we're both doing. I just did it, at the turn of the year, and you're now reducing the time you spend on your jobby job, and you're starting to spend more time on this podcast, on 9to5 Mac, and things like that. So going indie is a pretty big step, at least it was for me. It's something I've been thinking about for a long time, and I'm sure it's the same for you. So I thought it would be interesting just to talk a little bit about why we're making this like pretty big step. So what is it for you about like becoming independent again? Because I know that's something you've done in the past, and kind of reducing the time you spend on your day job. What was kind of the main motivation for you?
Yeah, so this is something that's been always like my goal in life. I've never been a jobby job kind of person. In fact, the job I have now is my only job in iOS ever, and it's probably the first and last one I'm gonna have. Not because I don't like it, because I do love it, and we're gonna talk more about this later. But I do all of these cool things, and fortunately, many of them are actually making me money, like 9to5, like Chibi Studio, which is my iOS app we talked about a lot, and also the podcast stuff, so and AirBuddy and everything else I do. So fortunately, I don't need my jobby job to be able to like pay the rent and eat and all of that stuff. So I thought it was about time I had a little more time to dedicate to my side stuff, because it is kind of stressful and draining to have like a full-time job and still do everything else I do, because I end up not having that much time left for other stuff, like just relaxing and not doing anything and like going out on a walk. Even though I do that sometimes, I don't have that much time right now to do that stuff that's important for my health.
Yeah.
So basically the main motivation was like, I don't need the job for money, even though I like it, and even though the extra money is good to have. And I want to have more time to dedicate to my other stuff, which I also love.
Yeah, exactly. Like that equation is really tough sometimes, because especially if you have a lot of ideas, you have a lot of things you want to do, you have a lot of projects and a lot of like different things that you're juggling, it can be really, really difficult to prioritize. And especially if you have that fixed amount of hours that you have to work, whether it's like 40 hours per week or, you know, in my case, I was doing about 30 hours of freelancing per week before, the end of the year. And when you have that fixed amount of hours, it's really, really hard to prioritize other things. And for me, like, I had so many ideas. Like, one thing, for example, was I had so many people, like, almost every single day reach out to me and ask me to create more kind of beginner-friendly content. Because, you know, as many people might be aware, I do every Sunday, I write a new article on my website, which tends to be, like, a little bit more advanced in nature. It's not really, you know, geared towards beginners, but there's a lot of beginners out there, and a lot of people are asking me to create some of this stuff. But I didn't have time to do it because I only had those very, very small amount of hours that I could dedicate to Swift by Sonel and to creating content and podcasting and things like that. But now, one of the first things I did actually once I kind of went indie was to create Swift by Sonel Basics, which is a new article series that I'm doing, which I'll keep updating throughout the year and, you know, hopefully forever, where I am creating beginner-friendly content for the first time. And that's just an example of, you know, once you are able to dedicate more hours, like actual, you know, physical hours to something, you're able to not only make it better, but you're able to kind of branch out and to try new things, which, you know, before I wasn't able to. I was only able to kind of keep those weekly articles coming. That was the only kind of time I had. So that's what I think is going to be huge for me this year, is to be able to launch all these new projects that I have been having at the back of my mind for years, but I can now finally kind of make reality.
Yeah, and like for me, one big motivator was Chibi Studio, because this app we've been developing, me and my friend, since 2016. And it's it brings in like a semi-reliable income every month for both of us. And we've been working on this version 2 of the app, which is like a huge update, almost like completely redesigning the entire app. And it's tough to like only be able to work on it on weekends and at nights, and that's when I'm not doing other stuff. So I would really like to like be able to like wake up on Monday and like, today I'm going to work on this feature, and I'm going to start in the morning and work until the afternoon, and I'm going to finish it. Like on the weekends, you have other things going on. Maybe you have like a dinner with someone, or you have an event going on, and it's not as easy to like focus on like doing work on a specific project. Like from, and I work, I know you're not like that, but I work the best when I can like sit down on my computer and like work for 6 hours without stopping. That's right. How I work the best. And then after that, I stop and I go outside or I do something else. But I really need that extended period of time where I'm focusing on just that one task.
Yeah, I mean, I think I have the same, but I like to take a lot more breaks in between. I like to, you know, split the thing I'm doing up into smaller chunks and then do those smaller chunks. But I definitely agree, like being able to say, you know, for example, the basic series that I mentioned, that was something where, you know, at the beginning of the year, I was able to say, okay, let me just sit down now and write these three articles. Like, I'm going to write these three articles today. And that's like, I write one article, I take a break, and I write another one, take a break, etc. And that is just like that kind of extra control over your time, and having that extra time to actually be able to do that is incredible. And that's like the main motivator for me. And that's something I mentioned earlier in this episode, where I said the goal for most indies is just to, you know, make enough from the thing that we make so that we can make more stuff. And that's kind of, you know, what I'm doing right now, is like I'm able to make more stuff. Like I'm able to spend more time making even more content for the community, because you know, I have sponsors for Swift by Sandel. We have sponsors now for Stacktrace. And that's, you know, something that will enable us to spend more time on this show. So I think it all kind of works together as like one, this kind of continuous circle once you get it going. But of course, for me, this has been like 2+ years in the making. So it's not something that happened overnight. It's just been like growing and growing from the moment I kind of started doing content creation, where honestly, I had no dreams or plans, or, you know, my wildest dreams that I would ever be able to do this full time. But it's kind of been just organically growing from there. And I think that's also something that's worth mentioning, where, you know, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, oh, I would like to go indie, I think that, you know, continuously working towards a goal and having this North Star and you're, you know, working towards it, and you have a plan, is usually like a kind of more sustainable way than just like jumping into it. Because if I think the moment I started Swift by Sandel, for example, if I would have just jumped into it, I think I would have made very different decisions. And I think, you know, for example, the site probably wouldn't be completely free or anything like that. I probably would have more pressure to kind of monetize from day one. Well, now I've been just growing into this nice model that I have going on right now, just organically throughout the years. And I think that's just a way to build something more sustainably.
Yeah, when you have that pressure to monetize, you end up making completely different decisions. And sometimes the end result is not as good as if you were working towards a goal of having something good out there that then became monetizable. Like that's why many companies tech companies, like they launch without any monetization plan or anything, and they are VC funded, and then after many, many years in business, then they start deciding how to monetize, and it's usually selling user data, but that's another topic. But yeah, when you have that pressure to oh, I need to start this right now and I need to make money from day one, it's a lot harder.
Yeah, absolutely. And it enables you to also kind of figure out what you want to do. And because as soon as you start, you know, taking money from someone, whether that's sponsors or from users, or you have subscriptions, or, you know, you sell an app or you sell books or whatever it is that you're selling, you always have a pressure to deliver something, because no one's going to give you money for free. I think also, like, if you spend some time establishing what it is that you're making first, and also, like, you know, having that as your main goal. Like, again, the goal for me is to create content, and not really necessarily to make money from it, but the money I can use to make more content. And I think if you start in that angle, you're usually going to end up building something better. Like, to your point also, where, you know, you are focused on your passion, you're focused on what you want to build, rather than just thinking about monetization the first thing.
Yeah, so we are both going indie, and we are still going. Like Tim Cook likes to say, we're not stepping off the gas. So
customer sat is off the charts.
Also, yeah, that's also true. So we'll keep going, and we'll see where our indie adventure gets us.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll, of course, talk more about this on future episodes as well. And, you know, if you have any questions for us, you can always post it to Twitter. You can always tweet with the hashtag AskStackTrace. You can contact us directly, of course, and all those good stuff. But for now, we reached the end of this episode. So all that remains is for us to first thank our really good sponsors, both Max Stadium. You can go to maxstadium.com/stacktrace to find out more. And Hyper, you can check out the show notes for a really great deal on the Hyper wireless AirPods charging case. If people want to find us, you can go to Twitter, and you can find Rambo @_inside. You can find me @JohnSundell. But of course, the most important is to thank you so much, everybody, for listening to our first episode of season 2. We hope you'll stick with us for the whole season, and we're going to have so much fun doing this show every single week. But for now, that's it. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.